This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, what do runners think when they're pounding the pavement? A researcher is trying to learn about running by listening to these thoughts. We'll also hear about some interesting new findings in brain cancer research at Yale University. But first, the Yale Quantum Institute opens this week with an event called Quantum Science, The Coming of the New Information Age, moderated by NPR science reporter Joe Palca. I'd like to pretend I know anything about how quantum science is bringing us into a new information age, but frankly, I can't. So let's turn first to Rob Sholkoff, who's director of the Yale Quantum Institute and Sterling Professor of Applied Physics and Physics at Yale University. He joins us from Yale today. Rob, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Before we get into the deep conversation about quantum science, let's just talk about the Institute. What exactly is it that you're launching this week?
Yes, well, the Quantum Institute is a new interdisciplinary initiative at Yale, trying to bring together the members of the Yale community who are interested in quantum information and quantum computing. We'll host visitors from around the world to make sure we stay in contact with the leading scientists and engineers working on this area, and hopefully to try and eventually build new facilities and expand the efforts in this very exciting area.
Okay, so let's talk about this exciting area called one of the most critical and important scientific fields of the 21st century. What exactly is it we're talking about when we're talking about quantum information science?
Well, quantum information science is a new paradigm or new set of ideas for how we might store and process information. And it's hoped that this could be one of the ways that we can extend and accelerate the kind of amazing progress that we've all seen in the current information age.
Extend and accelerate, and you're referring to something we've talked about in the past, the famous Moore's Law, the idea that computing power has been really changing and expanding every couple years for the entire history of computing, and maybe it's about to reach its limits. You're talking about expanding this beyond what we can conceive of right now.
That's right. The engineers and computer scientists who are working on conventional computers and continuing Moore's Law are worried about the fact that eventually there'll be a limit to how far they can miniaturize things, and you will reach the quantum scale where all your transistors are on the size of a single atom. And then basically the rules will change, and you have to sort of take quantum mechanics and the different rules of physics that apply for those things at that scale into account.
The rules of physics in quantum mechanics, there are descriptors used like weird and counterintuitive and spooky. And that's part of one of the things that I think attracts a lot of lay people, but it's also the stuff that confuses the heck out of us. So maybe you can just explain what's weird about how some of this quantum information works compared to what we're fairly used to now in traditional computer science, say.
Right. Well, part of the idea, too, of quantum information is that we're learning that these rules are not so much weird, but just different. So in conventional computers, one of the most basic ideas is that you represent your information as bits, which are just either 0 or 1. And in quantum computing, you replace those bits with their quantum equivalent. We call them qubits, that are some sort of atomic system or quantum element that can have two different states, which could be 0 or 1. But in quantum mechanics, an atom, let's say, doesn't have to be only in one state or the other. It can be placed in something called a superposition, which really is being in both states at once.
Okay, so it's in both states at once. How does that help us?
Well, in an ordinary computer, of course, you have to decide whether your bits are going to be 0 or 1, and they should never be indeterminate. But in the ideas of quantum computing, we will use this superposition principle to allow the computer, in effect, to explore many possibilities at once. And that can give, for certain problems, we believe, an incredible speed up in the way you can process information.
So put this into practical use for us. We're going to now build a supercomputer of the near future, and we're going to try to solve an enormous problem. How does this help us? What exactly can we do, say?
Well, one thing you can do with quantum information is store vastly larger amounts of information in your collection of bits than you can classically. So even a few hundred quantum bits is equivalent to astronomical numbers of classical bits that one could never build. It also allows you to do certain problems that are intractable using, we believe, using conventional computers.
Where are we right now in the history of this type of research? I mean, do you feel like you're at the very, very start of something, or do you feel as though you're just about ready for a breakthrough that will allow us to build the type of quantum computers that do just the thing you described?
Right. Well, I think the field is right now at a very exciting kind of tipping point. So for the last 10 or 15 years, people have been trying to do very basic science experiments to prove these concepts and to establish whether there are really practical ways of creating interesting devices using these techniques. And I'd say that most of the experts now believe we kind of have a scientific existence proof that it will be possible to build fairly large-scale quantum information devices in the foreseeable future. And the question now is sort of, what will we use them for, what will they look like exactly, and how long will it take to develop them?
What will we use them for? I mean, what do you see as the first real practical application, the first way we can raise enough money and enough will to get something like this built?
Well, of course, there's a huge amount of momentum and emphasis behind keeping this Moore's Law or the progression of information technology going. So that's one of the driving forces. But I think, I would punt a little bit on that question, especially when I look at the history of conventional or classical computing. So in the sort of formative days, or when the first computers were being built and people were just understanding what it meant to program a computer and what you would use it for, they had a few ideas in mind that were sort of specialized and either scientific or military. And most of the things that we now use computers for and that have affected people's lives so much weren't really imagined or invented until we had some useful hardware. And so I think in this field, we're kind of right at that stage where, let's say we have a few quantum transistors and we're just trying to build interesting quantum computers. And the hope is that we will still have to discover all the things they're really most useful for and can be applied for. But there are a few things that we already know could be very attractive.
Well, and I just want to let our listeners know that we're talking about the new Yale Quantum Institute, and its director, Rob Sholkoff, joins us from Yale University today. They're kicking off with a program called Quantum Science, the Coming of the New Information Age, which is moderated by NPR science reporter Joe Palca. It's happening later today, and you're listening to Where We Live. This is something that I often talk with researchers about, is this notion that sometimes we need a really big problem to solve. We need to figure out a way to focus our energies to try to do this. And one of the worries perhaps about life in 2015 is so much of the brain power that we spend is really just trying to make our handheld devices work a little bit faster for us, or trying to solve something so that some company can make a tiny little bit more money off of selling us something in a certain way. Do you feel like we need some sort of big national or global problem to solve that will help us get to the point where we have the will to maybe make these types of breakthroughs?
Well, that sounds very much like a policy question, I guess. In quantum information, I think there are a few examples of sort of big motivators behind this research. So one thing that was learned early on is that this computing paradigm could be applied for cryptography and for breaking people's codes. And so that's led to a fairly large amount of government investment in this area. The other things that people have figured out we could use quantum computers for are solving other kinds of quantum problems. So for instance, trying to design new materials or understand how to make better drugs rationally and modeling them on a computer of this type. These are things which are, you know, motivating and driving the field until we can figure out those other applications.
But here's a big one. It's something that I've heard you talk about. A quantum computer might help us devise a catalyst to sequester CO2 from the environment. This is the sort of thing that maybe could be applied to one of our biggest problems happening on the globe right now, global warming. What do you say?
So that's something that a few people have been promoting lately. So one of the things we believe quantum computers are really good at are solving, as I said, quantum problems like quantum chemistry. And so we hope that we could devise things that would fix nitrogen better and lead to better fertilizers, or you know, solve sort of relevant problems like that using this technology.
What are the biggest barriers you have right now that you see?
Well, building a practical quantum computer is technically very, very challenging. We have to basically master this quantum domain and be able to control an extremely large number of individual atoms or these individual quantum bits simultaneously with fairly high precision. And so there's a, you know, it's going to require basically completely different technology than today's silicon and CMOS transistors. And so there's a host of different approaches to that, ranging from, you know, trapping ions in a vacuum chamber and shining lasers on them, to more solid state approaches such as superconducting circuits, which is an area of my specialty and a particular strength here at Yale.
Is there a certain amount of fragility to these systems that you have to worry about too, that perhaps need to be devised in a way over time, because they're easily, either the information that they carry or the devices themselves are easily breakable?
Absolutely. So, you know, because we're sort of miniaturizing, if you like, the computer to some ultimate extent, or we're storing the information in the smallest possible carrier, just one excitation of some object, it becomes fairly fragile, and any interaction with the outside world or the influence of noise can cause the bit to forget, as it were, to change its state when we didn't want it to do that. And the ideas of something called quantum error correction, which is a way of making a computation robust even in the presence of some finite amount of this noise and errors, is one of the main scientific challenges that our team and people around the world are really working on. That's sort of the last big hurdle to conquer before we can make a scalable version of a quantum computer.
I would think one of the most exciting things for you about this institute opening up is that you really are bringing people from all sorts of disciplines from around the Yale community and really from around the world to talk about this. Could you just explain to us what that's like to get a chance to sit down and work closely with people from different disciplines to try to solve this really incredibly complex problem that's obviously exciting everyone, but in a different way?
Right. Well, it's as I said, you know, it's with any new thing, you're not quite sure where the good ideas are going to come from or how you're going to solve problems that we've never faced before. And so, you know, in this discipline, we need physicists, obviously, and that was a lot of the people who began working in this area. But also more and more, we need electrical engineers, we need computer scientists, material scientists, and others. And one of the challenges sometimes is learning how to translate between the different disciplines. And so one of the things that's fun about quantum computing is we've developed ways of applying kind of computer science or information theory to understanding and explaining quantum physics in a simpler and better way.
Well, thanks for translating a little bit for our audience and for me today. I do appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
Rob Sholkoff is director of the Yale Quantum Institute and Sterling Professor of Applied Physics and Physics at Yale University. He joined us today from the Yale University studios. They've got a discussion coming up today, Quantum Science, the Coming of the New Information Age, moderated by NPR science reporter Joe Palca. Coming up, what do long-distance runners think when they're running? We'll talk to a researcher who has the answer. It's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, a few conversations about science. So joining us now is Patrick Scahill. He's WNPR's science reporter. He writes our science blog, The Beaker. Hi there, Patrick.
Hey, John.
Now, I don't know about you, Patrick, but when I go out for a run, and you're much more of a runner than I am, The thoughts that go through my head sound something like this. It's like this, ow, 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 ow. And sometimes it's like, when will this be over? Will this be over? I mean, that's what I'm thinking when I'm running, and I can actually almost hear myself. Similarly for you?
Yeah, actually, I went out for a run yesterday just to kind of – I'm more of a jogger than a runner. We can talk about the difference later.
Oh, sure. I want to hear about that.
I'm focused on the pain.
Yeah. I don't even know if I'm a jogger. I'm not even going that fast. Now, you've been reporting on research that actually captures information like this, like what joggers and runners are thinking to find out more about long-distance running. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, so to talk about the current study, maybe just very quickly, we'll talk about some prior studies that have been done. And most of those studies were sort of retroactive, which means they were talking to runners after they had gone out and done something like a marathon and basically giving them surveys, asking them how they feel. In this new study that we're going to talk about, the most interesting thing to me about this was that actually it was done in real time. Runners were outfitted with recorders. They were sent out into the field and basically told to do stream of consciousness talking into a microphone to kind of try to capture what they were actually thinking as they were feeling and experiencing it.
My goodness. So let's talk to one of the researchers. Dr. Ashley Sampson is associate professor at California State University, Northridge. Dr. Sampson, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, if you want to call us, 860-275-7266, let us know if you're a long-distance runner, what you're thinking when you run. Again, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Dr. Sampson, what big questions were you trying to answer in this study?
Well, one of the major things we wanted to really get at was, you know, as Patrick mentioned, most of the current research is retrospective in nature. And so we're asking people to sort of remember what they were thinking and feeling, you know, something that they had done previously. And we wanted to really capture, you know, that experience as it was happening to see if perhaps maybe it was different. You know, because we do know that, you know, relying on people's memory can sometimes have its limitations in terms of our own personal biases and, you know, just how our opinions or how our thoughts can be colored based on the outcome of that event, you know, after the fact. And so we wanted to see if we could get at it while it was happening, but then also just testing out the feasibility of using such a protocol. You know, when my fellow researchers and I were originally conceptualizing this study, you know, our big question was, can we actually get runners to go out with a microphone for 4 hours and talk to us? You know, so we really wanted to see if we could even accomplish that with this very first study. And we were really excited to find out that, you know, they were very willing to participate and do the protocol during their training runs. So that's, you know, that was really exciting for us.
And in just a couple of minutes, we'll actually hear some tape from one of these runners, and you can only imagine some of the things that people must say. I want to ask you, though, Doctor, about the things that you're hoping to really get out of all this. I mean, obviously, knowing how runners are feeling during a run or what they're saying to themselves during a run might help you get a little bit to, I don't know, their endurance, their performance, how they recover afterward. I mean, what are the big things you might be able to learn out of this?
Well, as a sports psychology professional, you know, we're always looking to understand how do we help set people up for success. And so, you know, long term, what we would like to be able to discern is, you know, what are the more successful runners doing? What are they thinking? What are they saying to themselves versus, you know, maybe the less successful runners, so that we can hopefully look at, you know, some intervention points, you know, as sports psychology professionals working with these individuals. You know, how do we best set them up for success? You know, learning what works, what doesn't work, and being able to, you know, get that data, again, in real time as it's happening. So, you know, when someone gets to a difficult point in their run, what are the people who actually push through doing versus the people who maybe slow down or give up doing? And really trying to explore what those differences might be. And, you know, our long-term goal is to really be able to, so when we sent the runners out, we actually gave them GPS watches, so we gave them Garmin, and so we have their GPS data, and what we would like to eventually do is overlay the GPS data with their transcripts of all of their thoughts, and so we can eventually be able to really look at, you know, objectively, oh, look, you see right here, you know, John Smith is getting kind of negative and a little bit off track in terms of losing his focus. And you see his pace start to drop off, but then he uses a refocusing technique or uses some positive self-talk, and then you see his pace get back on track to where he wanted to be. And so to be able to see that in real time, you know, it's something that is very, very limited in terms of the research in our field, you know, in terms of other studies that have done something like that. And so that's what we would really like to be able to do long-term, is to be able to discern out, you know, what are the successful runners doing when times get tough, you know, when it gets challenging, versus, you know, what are perhaps the less successful runners doing.
We're talking with Dr. Ashley Sampson, associate professor at California State University, Northridge, about this study about long-distance runners and some of the things they're saying and thinking and feeling while they're running. We're talking about this with Patrick Scahill, who's been reporting on this for his blog, The Beaker, and for WNPR. If you want to join us, we'd like to hear from some long-distance runners about what they think and how they feel as they run. 860-275-7266, this positive self-talk. Help get you through that last grueling mile. Patrick?
So, Ashley, we're going to hear from some of the tape that you collected. And I think it was like over 18 hours of tape that you actually got from these runners, right? I mean, it was a lot of stuff.
Yes.
That you. But before we listen to the tape, Ashley, just very quickly, describe kind of the rubric you use to get people to say what they were feeling. I think it was something called the Think Aloud Protocol. Is that right?
Yes. So this was developed by two researchers in the late 80s, Erickson and Simon. And they originally used this protocol in the stress and coping area of research. So they would put people in stressful situations and have them sort of think aloud, you know, how they were, you know, dealing with or coping with that stressful situation. And then, you know, some researchers adopted it into the sport world for some more, you know, short-term tasks, so like a golf putt or a shot in pools. And so having the athletes in those situations talk through, you know, how are you setting yourself up, what are your strategies, what are your plans, and then actually executing it, and again, tie that to better or worse performance. And so with this particular protocol, essentially, you know, the athletes are hooked up to a microphone and a recorder, and they're given the instructions to simply just think aloud. And so the idea is that, you know, like you were mentioning earlier, the sort of stream of consciousness, you know, whatever is passing through your head, you know, just sort of spit it out, right? So we're not asking them to explain it or describe it or edit it in any way. It's just whatever's there, sort of the raw data, if you will, just spit it out for us. And, you know, researchers found that there are different levels of verbalizations. And so with this particular protocol, we're really focused on what are called level 1 and 2 verbalizations, which is where we're simply just asking them to, again, just spit out what's in your head. We're not asking them to interpret it for us or describe it or manipulate it in any way. So we don't want to affect sort of the organic thoughts that are going on, and we don't want to affect performance. And research has shown that if, you know, athletes are simply asked to just sort of spit out what's in your head, keeping it at that level 1 and 2 range, that it doesn't affect performance. And so what we did is we, you know, had the runners come in. We hooked them up to the recorder and the microphone, and we had them actually practice on the treadmill, you know, just getting used to the protocol. And you know, a member of the research team was right there if they had questions or difficulties, or also to just kind of prompt them if they were silent for a long period of time. And then once they felt comfortable with the protocol, then we actually gave them the recorder and the microphone and, you know, the instructions for how to work it and, you know, send them out. And over the next week, they were to do one of their long runs and take the recorder and the microphone with them. And so these were all runners who were currently training for something. So they were doing at least one long run a week. And so we weren't asking them to necessarily do something they weren't already going to do. We were just asking them to add the talking component to it.
Well, let's actually listen to a short montage of some of the audio that you've collected from some of the runners here.
Oh, God, I already feel tired.
I gotta be tired today. I'm already thinking about that last mile to the car. Usually when you take 2 weeks off, you feel good. I'm miserable. It's gotta kick in. It's gotta kick in where it feels good.
Those are some sounds of the runners that you recorded. And I don't know. This is fascinating. There's a lot of stuff in there. One of them has to do with, you know, obviously a lot of the runners are probably verbalizing about just how tired they are. I mean, how much did you hear that as a theme?
It was a big theme. You know, interestingly enough, our biggest theme was pace and distance, which would make sense because, as I mentioned earlier, these are runners who are training for a race. And so when they're going out on these runs, they're having specific goals in mind in terms of, I need to run this many miles at this pace. You know, it's part of their training program. And so that was the biggest theme, was people paying attention to, you know, how far have I gone? How far do I have left to go? What is my pace? Am I on pace? Do I need to speed it up or do I need to slow it down? But then the second biggest theme that we found was the pain and discomfort. Because again, you know, you know, when you're running long distances, inherently there's going to be some discomfort, right? We're pushing our bodies, you know, far. We're trying to, you know, run faster paces. And again, we're trying to achieve training goals. And so there's going to be some pain and discomfort in there. What was really interesting, though, is that if you look at some of the other running research that has looked at, you know, what are the runners dealing with and pain and discomfort, a lot of distance runners, you know, just accept the fact that pain and discomfort are just a part of, you know, the sport. And, you know, for a lot of runners, they talk about that, you know, by being able to sort of be, quote-unquote, mentally tough and push through those painful experiences, it helps to give them that sense of accomplishment and confidence, not only in their specific running sport, but just in life in general. You know, the sort of thinking of, you know, if I can handle this and push through this, then I can handle anything else that life might throw at me. And that's been a theme that I've seen in some of my other running research that wasn't related to this Think Aloud protocol. But we did see that, of course, that, you know, because it is a big part of the experience, that was a big part of the runner's thought.
Well, one of the other things that one of the runners was saying, though, Patrick, and this has always been the mystical, magical piece of this that I know there's been a lot of research on, but frankly, it's something that I've never found, right? The runner talks about it's going to kick in, that time when it feels good. And this is something that, athletes all search for, right? You train long enough and you run and you begin to get this euphoria. It's called the runner's high. And these runners, I'm sure, are searching for this. But I don't know if all of us ever find it.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that Ashley was looking at in her study was how long runners actually focused on the pain that they were experiencing. And I think there's probably a takeaway for coaches, right? I mean, when we're looking at this data, in a lot of cases, I think, Ashley, and correct me if I'm wrong, runners kind of stop talking about pain after the first mile or two. And the idea for a coach would be to basically go back to your athlete and say, look, it's going to hurt. It's supposed to hurt. Make your peace with that and realize that, you know, later on, you're going to get some of the positive benefits from this run.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And you know, with listening to the recordings, a lot of it was, you know, some of that what we call the warm-up effect, you know, that first mile or two, you're loosening up, you're warming up, all those little aches and pains kind of have to loosen up and shake out. And what we saw was that a lot of the runners, as they continued longer and longer in their run, that, you know, the talking about pain really kind of went away. Because, yeah, at a certain point during your run, especially when you're running these longer distances, we had one participant who took us on a 20-mile run with him. You know, and you make peace with it, and you accept that this is, you know, this is the experience, this is where you are, and let's get through it. And
I want to get to some phone calls here. Some runners are calling us at 860-275-7266 with thoughts. Adam's in Farmington. Hi, Adam.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Good. I was just calling in to say, you know, I use running as a therapy. I went through a rough time 8 years ago. I'm a recovering gambler. And when I'm running, for example, a marathon, the second half, I recall the rough times that I went through 8 years ago, and that helps me forget about the pain that I'm going through when I'm running. So, you know, second half of marathon is all mental, really, to me. And I recall what I do is I recall what I went through 8 years ago, and that helps me go through a long distance running.
And you are actually using these thoughts to propel you along, especially in the harder part of that race, right?
Yes. As tough it is, second half of the marathon, when I recall what I went through 8 years ago, it makes it a lot easier. And actually, I use running as a therapy. And I met a lot of other people who also use running as a therapy through their recovery.
Adam, thank you so much for talking about the therapeutic benefits of this. Let's go to Jake, who's calling from Hartford. Hey, Jake.
Oh, hey. First-time caller. Thanks so much for putting me on.
Of course, yeah.
So I've been running cross-country competitively since high school and in college. I'm only around 24, so I find when you run in groups and you actually have conversation, it allows you to, you know, completely take your mind off what you're doing, which is, you know, physically you know, putting yourself through a good amount of pain. And it allows you to just take it to the next level. And you can actually have a comfortable conversation while you're exerting a lot of effort. You can really, I don't know, just, you know, get to a new level that, before you, better than you have before, I guess.
That's really interesting, Jake. I see a lot of people who do that and run in groups and are having conversations along the way. Do you feel like when you're running completely by yourself and you're not able to have that conversation, your self-talk is somewhat different? Does it make it harder for you to run long distances?
Yeah, exactly. And I live near a reservoir, and when I run in circles, I can see, okay, I have to, there, I'm going to be there in 10 minutes. Man, I have so much further to go. When you're having a conversation that's more natural or organic, you're not thinking about, okay, I have to exert this much more effort before I make it this much further. It's much more you're thinking, you're in the moment, and you know, by the end of the run, you think, you realize, wow, you know, I accomplished this, and I barely realized it.
Hey, Jake, thank you very much for that. So, Patrick, that's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of what Ashley's study is. It's about what people are thinking, how maybe they can use some sort of positive reinforcement to propel themselves along their route. Jake's talking about something different that a lot of people do in any physical activity, which is just take my mind off it completely. Just let the body go, and as long as I'm having the conversation with someone, I just don't even feel it.
Right. Yeah, and I wonder just, Ashley, I mean, in terms of sort of one other thing that I wanted to just talk about very quickly was like the environment that people are running in.
Sure.
And I wonder how that kind of turned up in the information that you gathered, Ashley.
Yeah, so that was actually one of the major themes that we found, was looking at the environment. You know, people were paying attention to their surroundings. You know, I'll share that, you know, the data was collected out here in Southern California. And so it perhaps might have been a little bit different if we had been somewhere that maybe wasn't quite as ideal in terms of weather and location. You know, being out here, we were surrounded by beautiful mountains with trails, and we have the ocean and a bunch of beautiful places to run. And again, of course, we have the Southern California weather. And so it was really interesting because, you know, in the midst of people complaining about, you know, how much it hurt and how much farther they had to go, there, you know, people were also being grateful and expressing gratitude, appreciation for, you know, wow, this is a beautiful sunrise, or, oh, you know, I get to run on this beautiful trail, how lucky am I, or, oh, the temperature is perfect this morning, you know, this is wonderful. And so, you know, the environment definitely played a part as well in terms of, you know, what people were just paying attention to. And for some people that was, you know, woven in with the, you know, kind of pace and distance. And so they would say, okay, I'm going to get to that tree or get up this hill. You know, so giving themselves sort of landmarks to get to, so kind of using the environment as part of their training. And, you know, to what the previous caller mentioned about, you know, running with other people and having conversations and doing things to take your mind off of it, there's been a lot of research in the sport world with this concept of association versus dissociation. And what your caller was talking about is dissociation, which is where you do something to sort of distract yourself from what you're going through. And then the association is where runners really, or athletes really, tune in to what they're feeling. And so, you know, again, and there's not necessarily a right or wrong for which path you choose. It's just figuring out for you what works best in terms of getting the performances that you want. And then also just making sure that it's fun. Because at the end of the day, it does have to have some sort of enjoyable component to it.
I'd like to take some of your Southern California runners and slap a recorder on them in Bristol, Connecticut in January and see what they're saying.
Yeah.
You might be hearing some different stuff. Let's quickly go to John in Middletown as we're talking about long-distance running with Patrick Scahill and Ashley Sampson. Hi, John.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Long-time listener.
Yeah.
I've been running for 15 years. I got into running to address some anxiety and depression issues I'd been dealing with. And it's really how I've been able to maintain a good level of sanity, really. But over the past 5 years, I started really getting into long-distance running marathons. And for me, running long distance or even short distances was always – I've always looked at it as a form of meditation and focusing on my breath, really, and just quieting my mind. That's where a lot of my anxiety comes from. I can't quiet my mind. I relive things throughout the day. I relive things from my past. So running has really helped me hone those meditative skills.
Well, hey, John, I want to actually put that to Ashley. Thank you so much for the phone call. There's another piece of it, right? The whole notion of running as meditation, it's something that it's obviously repetitive. One step after another, you begin to breathe in a certain pattern. And this is something we haven't really talked about yet, but John's talking about the meditative qualities of this.
Yes, no, I can completely resonate with that. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at some of the research that looks at exercise as medication, so looking for, you know, at which patients are people with, you know, clinical level anxiety, depression, other sorts of psychological disorders, that, you know, repetitive activities have been found to hit sort of something on our most primitive psychological level where it's psychologically soothing to us. And so running and walking like that, where it's just large muscle group repetitive movements, have been highly recommended for a long time in the psychology field as a way to sort of help combat the symptoms of those disorders. And there's definitely a meditative piece to running. You know, and I think that sort of weaves into the idea of what we were talking about earlier, this runner's high. You know, you sort of get to this meditative state where, you know, it literally is one foot in front of the other, which, you know, can be a great metaphor for life. You know, just knowing, okay, if I just keep breathing and if I just keep putting one foot in front of the other, I'm going to get this hill. I'm going to finish my run. I'm going to accomplish whatever, you know, task I'm trying to accomplish in my life. And so, you know, there's a lot of research that supports, you know, what John is expressing.
We got a tweet from Matt who says he ran his second marathon 2 weeks ago. The runner's high came early, but by mile 22, my thoughts turned to miles to go. Let's quickly go to Chris in Torrington. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, John. Love your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
The dialogue today is incredible. This is a really interesting topic to me. And I don't so much have a question. I actually have a comment and potentially a resource for the research that we're discussing today.
Yeah.
It is a film called 100 Head, Heart, Feet. And it's a documentary of, full disclosure, one of my friends running the storied Vermont 100. And there is a ton of audio and video of what he is experiencing in those moments, in those miles of a very long distance race. I just thought it's a great film, and I, of course, wanted to plug it a bit, but I also thought it would be great for this research.
Hey, Chris, thank you very much, and we'll mark that down. And Ashley, before I let you go, I should ask, okay, we've talked about long distance runners, people training for marathons, and Chris just mentioned people run 100 miles at a time. Patrick said it earlier, a lot of us who run are really just joggers, right? I run 2 or 3 miles tops at a time a couple times a week. Anything in your research for us, anything we can learn when we're not necessarily training for a big race, we're just trying to stay in shape?
Most definitely, you know. And the reason we wanted to take the longer distance runners is because we wanted to see, you know, what the thoughts were like over longer periods of time. You know, however, I think there are some good takeaways from this for people who run any distance. You know, I think one of the biggest ones is what we were talking about earlier with this idea of the pain, discomfort, and knowing that it will go away. You know, because even when someone starts to go out for, say, you know, just a 3 mile run, that first half mile is still going to be pretty uncomfortable as your body starts to warm up. And so, you know, one of my big things that I always talk to people about when they tell me that they want to take up running is, you know, just get through the first mile and then it gets better. You know, because most people think that, oh, if it hurts this bad the first mile, you know, there's no way I'm going to make it to mile 2 or 3. But I try to encourage them that, you know, it actually does get better if you just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And so I think we can definitely see that in this particular study. I mean, we saw it play out every single time.
Dr. Ashley Sampson's associate professor at California State University, Northridge. Thank you so much for sharing these stories, some of this tape with us, and all your research. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we're still here with Patrick Scahill, our science reporter. And Patrick, we just have a minute or so left,
yep.
But I got to say, you cover a lot of science stuff. And
right.
When we saw this story about a mystery star, all of a sudden I started thinking, Patrick's going to be so into this. What have you learned about this?
So very, very quickly, this was a star that was picked up by the Planet Hunters Project down at Yale. And they analyze light data that comes out of the Kepler Space Telescope. The nutshell explanation for how Kepler works is basically they're looking at light curves. So a star puts out some light, and when something goes in front of that star, it kind of dims the light for a little bit. And you see that in the chart. The graph kind of just of the light curve drops down. So very quickly, there was this one star. It's out in the direction of the constellation Cygnus, and it was just doing like some really, really, really weird stuff. The curve was bipping and bopping all over the place, and there really was no explanation for it. And we're talking about, you know, lots and lots of stars have been analyzed by Kepler, I think about 150,000, and researchers had never seen anything like this before. So what was it? Obviously, this was something that a lot of folks were wondering about. So I spoke with Tabitha Boyajian. She's an astronomer over at Yale, and she has one explanation for what she thinks it might be.
The comet itself is very small, but it has what we call, you know, a coma around it, right? That can actually block out a significant part of this light. So you can think of this as, you know, comet clumps kind of going in front of the star.
So comet clumps, basically, and we've written about this on thebeaker.org. You can learn more about it there. But basically, she thinks a field star passed in the direction of this other star and essentially sucked in a bunch of comets that zipped in front of it and made these really weird light curves. But kind of what happened during the week, to Tabitha's chagrin, I'm sure, was that the internet kind of picked this up, and this concept of a Dyson sphere was brought up, and basically people are saying it's alien megastructures, and there's, like, alien civilizations that are causing these weird curves. And SETI is actually going to investigate this, but at any rate.
Whether or not we're actually talking about alien civilizations with megastructures around this, or whether or not it's just something else really cool, which is this weird comet thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Patrick Scale, you can read more about this at thebeaker.org. Thanks so much for joining us, Patrick.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about some new brain science cancer research. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, education, home ownership, retirement. How do you choose your financial priorities? Join us for a special episode on money matters on the next Where We Live. We'll hear from financial experts and we'll be taking your calls. What personal finance questions keep you up at night? Hope you can call in on the next Where We Live. A diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer that spreads to the brain is always very scary and often deadly. But researchers at Yale have found a subset of patients with a rare mutation who are actually living much longer than their peers. Their findings point to optimism for some patients and toward even more promise for genetic testing and personalized medicine. Earlier this week, I talked to Kimberly Johung, assistant professor of therapeutic radiology at Yale, about what they found. Kimberly Johung, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So first of all, explain what you were looking for in this research that we're going to be talking about. What were you trying to find?
I think we're in a very exciting era where there's growth of personalized medicine for cancer treatments, as you know. And as we gain more information about cancers and their molecular drivers and their genetics, we're able to target these specific mutations and do a better job controlling cancers. What's new about our study is whether we can expand that approach to treatment of cancer that has spread to the brain.
And why is this so difficult? Why is this an important thing to deal with? Is it just that once cancer has spread to the brain, the prognosis for patients is always so dire?
I think it's in part two issues. One is exactly what you said. When cancer has spread to the brain, the prognosis is terminal. The other is that the brain protects itself off very well from most of the chemotherapies and drugs that we have developed. And because of this, progression in the brain can really be a problem once it occurs.
Explain through a little bit about what you found here. First of all, why don't you walk through for us what exactly non-small cell lung cancer is and how prevalent it is in patients?
There are really two main types of lung cancer, small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer, which is the more common. And in small cell lung cancer, about 30% of patients end up developing spread of their cancer to the brain. And more recently, we have found that there are these subsets of patients with non-small cell lung cancer who have mutations that specifically drive their cancer. And one of these is the ALK mutation that we have focused this research on. It's a rare mutation present in only 5% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer, but we know that because there are drugs that have been developed that specifically target that mutation, that patients can live really have an extended survival that's measured in years, despite the fact that typically prognosis for lung cancer is quite poor.
You say that this mutation is relatively rare. How rare is it once again?
It's been described to be present in about 5% of non-small cell lung cancers.
But it's not the only type of mutation that's out there, I assume.
There are other mutations that are similarly rare but also portend an excellent prognosis. So, for example, EGFR is another mutation that's commonly studied, and this patient population, I think, would be similar to the patient population with ALK mutations in lung cancer.
So the really surprising finding here is that you end up with people who have this fairly rare mutation. They're able to, if treated properly, live longer than patients who don't have this mutation. What's the reason why?
Exactly. So I think the very fascinating thing is most patients who have non-small cell lung cancer and brain metastases, their prognosis is measured in months. Median survival for those patients can be predicted to be about 6 to 7 months even with treatments that include radiation or surgery or other chemotherapies or drugs that they take. In the ALK mutated patients who have spread of cancer to the brain, we found that they're living 4 years on average, which is really a considerable difference compared to the majority of this population that has a very bleak prognosis. And we think that this is because the disease in their body is so well controlled by these targeted, personalized drugs that can basically target the mutation that drives their cancer. The problem is that when they develop cancer that spreads to the brain and the drugs can't get to the brain, we believe that if we use radiation to treat the brain disease and oftentimes repeated radiation, we can really gain control of not only the disease in the body, but also the disease that has spread to the brain. That allows these patients to have that extended survival of years.
You sound very enthusiastic about this, and I assume your enthusiasm has to do with not just the ability to treat the rare number of patients who have this specific mutation, but it's broader than that.
I think it certainly suggests something that's a lot broader, which is that now not only can we use genetic or molecular information about cancers to guide chemotherapies and drugs that are given in the bloodstream or by mouth, but we can use this molecular information to guide treatment decisions for spread of cancer to the brain and how we should direct their radiation. Radiation is the primary means of treating cancer that has spread to the brain. We sometimes use surgery, but that's really for select patients. So when we employ radiation to treat cancer that has spread to the brain, we can do this in two ways. We can either treat the whole brain with radiation, which you can imagine, is associated with a lot of cognitive side effects that we would like to be able to avoid in our patients, especially those that are living very long. Or we can deliver radiation that's very focused on individual spots of cancer in the brain. And this type of study that shows that we can have genetic information that guides us suggests that we can use this information to help direct us towards should we employ the whole brain radiation or can we get away with treating individual spots, and is that in fact a better treatment for patients that live a long time?
Obviously, there are going to be lots of things that work in concert for us to move even closer toward allowing people to live longer lives after having a cancer diagnosis. But I guess I'm wondering how much some of this genetic information and how much the ability to target people with personalized medicine, how much you think that this is really at the forefront of what cancer researchers are going to be spending their time on over the course of the next 5, 10, 20 years?
I think it's very much at the forefront of what research is focused on in the realm of cancer right now. There have been a lot of efforts to identify additional mutations that drive cancer or mutations that work in concert to drive cancers and then develop drugs that specifically target those mutations or use the prognostic information such as we have in this study to help you guide treatment decisions.
Before I let you go, what's the next thing you're working on?
We are trying to identify what are these mutations that can guide treatment decisions, and as part of that, we have started trying to sequence brain metastases, so individual lesions that have cancer lesions that have spread to the brain and have been resected for one reason or another, or maybe they've been biopsied. And we're trying to sequence the expressed DNA of those cancers to try to identify mutations that are associated with treatment response. Can we identify mutations that predict for better or worse response to radiation? And if we knew that information up front, could we use that to guide decision-making in terms of what treatment to use for these cancers?
Well, Kimberly Johung, thank you so much for sharing this with us, and I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having interest in our work.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown with Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Sarah Flaherty. You can continue the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live, and please have a great weekend.